episode 4 of Root the Truth podcast, What I Learned About Narcissism. Hey y'all, welcome to episode 4. This is What I Learned About Narcissism. I have to tell you, anyone who knows me has heard me talk about narcissism at one point or the other. Ever since I learned about narcissism, and I mean really what it was, which was probably about 8 years ago, I have just been changed. Like it truly changed my life. And I just felt like it was something that I could not have a podcast and not talk about. Like there's just no way. And I wanted to be really careful in how I framed it. And so that's why it's the 4th episode, even though I've been wanting to talk about this for forever. But I just wanted to be careful because I am not a psychologist and I am really kind of sharing my anecdotal experience plus, you know, research that I've done. But I just wanted to be respectful and do justice to the conversation. So hopefully I did that. But like I said, I just could not have a show and not at least dedicate one episode to talking about narcissism and particularly what I've learned from it, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what narcissism is. And if you don't really know what it is, you probably don't know what an immense effect it has on your life. And you might think like, yeah, there's a small amount of people that affects, but no, I mean, I would venture to say we all have been affected by at least one person that exhibited extreme narcissistic characteristics. So I'm going to go through, you know, the definition like I like to do. And this time I think I'm going with Psychology Today resources, and I'll put all the stuff in the show notes. But, you know, I'll talk about what it is, what it looks like, narcissists as they show up in the world, you know, how you can recognize them, and then how they operate in relationships, and then what you can do to heal from them, and some resources that I've found helpful. And again, I have to say that, you know, I'm going to be talking about narcissists in general because it's an easier way to say people who exhibit narcissistic characteristics. Like, I will go through kind of the continuum aspect, but just know that when I refer to narcissists as a whole, I'm talking about not necessarily people who have been diagnosed by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but people that when you hear the characteristics listed, you'll think, okay, I can associate that with someone. And like I said, I'm not a doctor, but these are just my observations mixed with research that I've done personally to help me heal from a lot of damage that I had in my life. So again, I hope you find it helpful. Yeah, I just look forward to sharing what I've learned with you, both from experience and from brilliant minds who have been generous enough to write what they know and publish it for free on the internet for people like you and I. Narcissists have an addiction disorder. They are strongly addicted to feeling significant. Like any addict, they will do whatever it takes to get this feeling often. That is why they're manipulative and future fakers. They promise change, but can't deliver if it interferes with their addiction. That is why they secure backup supply. Shannon L. Alder. So the first question we have to ask is, what is narcissism exactly? So the definition that I found on Psychology Today says that, quote, narcissism encompasses a hunger for appreciation and admiration, a desire to be the center of attention, and an expectation of special treatment reflecting perceived higher status. Well, I'm sure that everyone knows someone like that. And I think that's one of the misconceptions, is that if somebody exhibits, you know, a slightly more than average appreciation hunger, or, you know, they have an expectation for special treatment a little bit more than you do, then they're all of a sudden a narcissist. And I think that's been a conversation recently among psychologists that say that narcissism is on the rise, and it's attributed to social media culture. And it's saying that, you know, people who do certain things like take a lot of selfies or use a lot of filters or, you know, anything like that, you know, could be attributed to narcissism. And I think it's important to note that narcissism, much like racism, is on a continuum. There's, you know, the lower end, or, you know, the least damaging end, and then a more damaging or extreme end of the spectrum or continuum. So, you know, you can know someone who's a little vain, and that doesn't make them an extreme narcissist. And just like you can know someone who, or be someone who exhibits some maybe covertly microaggressive racist tendencies, and that doesn't necessarily make you a card-carrying KKK member. So I think that's important to note, and especially because in this conversation, I'm going to be talking about more of the more damaging end of the spectrum narcissists. These are the people who inflict abuse on people. And so, you know, when I'm talking about narcissists, I'm more on that end, not your cousin who, you know, has thousands of selfies in her photo album. Like, that's not who I'm talking about. I mean, it might be, but that's not who this is geared at necessarily. So yeah, it's on a continuum. And I think with that definition being kind of vague, what I found really helpful was an article that I'll post that had a test that is used. And it was really helpful to kind of see what psychologists use to determine whether or not someone has like narcissistic personality disorder, which, like I said, is more on the farther end of the spectrum. So it says, quote, someone with a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, sometimes only in fantasy, need for admiration from others, and lack of empathy beginning in childhood, as indicated by five of these characteristics. And so they have a list. And the characteristics are, has a grandiose sense of self-importance and exaggerates achievements and talents. Dreams of unlimited power, success, and brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. Believes he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by or should associate with other special or high status people or institutions. Requires excessive admiration. Unreasonably expects special favorable treatment or compliance with his or her wishes. Exploits and takes advantage of others to achieve personal ends, lacks empathy for the feelings and needs of others, and envies others or believes they're envious of him or her. So, yeah, I think it's interesting to note that it's five or more. So, like I said, you know, someone can have all of these, someone can have three of these. They don't necessarily consider them disordered unless they have five or more. But, you know, just listening to those, you can think of someone in your life who sounds like they have five or more of these. And, you know, I think it's just important to know what to look for, because as we'll talk about, it's almost like prevention is the best cure in this situation when dealing with narcissists. If you can know the signs and know kind of what to look for in a narcissist, it will go a long way in preventing you from getting in a deeper relationship than you need to be with a narcissist, because you can experience a lot of damage from that. So I have to say, it took everything in me not to say entanglement. And I'm just really sad that that word has been hijacked by popular media, because I'm a contrarian and I don't like to use popular things, but it is a perfect word for what it feels like to be in a relationship with a narcissist. You just feel very, very entangled with their entire life and what they want and their needs. So yeah, I think I came with deeper relationship, but honestly, it really, really is an entanglement. I just have to go ahead and use it. Basically, all of those characteristics boil down to grandiosity, or believing you're better than someone or basically everyone else, entitlement, thinking you deserve special things that you also think other people don't deserve, being self-righteous, contempt for others, bullying and taunting, and just acting in an all-around arrogant manner. And that's if you're talking about narcissism as a clinical disorder or as a personality trait. Like, you know, those traits right there are generally agreed upon as indications of narcissism. And again, just to note, narcissism isn't a kind of self-esteem, and this is from Harvard Magazine, so you know it's real. They say that equating confident people with narcissistic people is like equating happy and manic, and then concluding that happiness isn't a good thing after all. So it's not to say that you shouldn't have high self-esteem. It's saying that the traits, grandiosity, entitlement, self-righteousness, contempt for others, taunting, and bullying are maybe not so great. And honestly, when you start looking at why someone has those traits, as we'll see that they have nothing to do at all with high self-esteem. In fact, they are the opposite, because all psychological studies related to narcissism show that that deep hunger for that admiration and that entitlement really comes from a really deep insecurity. They use all those other things to compensate for the fact that they have real bone-crushing shame and inferiority complexes. That's a hard word for me to say, but they feel inferior. And in particular, they're very highly sensitive to shame and humiliation. So all the arrogance and the projection is really just a way for them to have defense mechanisms for that shame. And let me tell you, finding that out was a game changer for me. I feel like if that's the only thing that you hear today, is that when you experience someone who's a narcissist, it is not about you. The things that they're telling you are not about you. It's because they have a deep insecurity, a profound insecurity and shame that causes all of their behavior to just be behavior created by defense against shame. And once I knew that, I think it was almost like shackles falling off, in a sense, like, not to be dramatic, but seriously, because when you deal with a narcissist, the way that they abuse you is in character assassination and invalidation. And so you think that it really is about you, that you are less than or weak, but then learning that it's actually just a projection of how they feel is just like ground shaking, life altering. So I just want everyone, if you haven't really thought about narcissism, to just remember that forever, because interacting with them will mislead you into thinking that they're confident and you're unsure of yourself. That's kind of like their weapon of choice. And, you know, needless to say, that has a lot of negative consequences, especially if it's done over time, and especially if it's done in your formative years. And a lot of people think that, you know, dealing with a narcissist is in your romantic relationships only, or maybe in work settings, but it's also your family. You know, because narcissism is human, it makes sense that humans who have children could be narcissists. And so, you know, we don't like to think about it, but it's possible to have a narcissist dad or brother or sister or mother. And so if you're dealing with this kind of abuse as a child, it can shape how you think of who you are. So it's just really important to know that the narcissist is acting out of defense for their own shame, and it's not about you and any character flaws you have, because you don't have them. The narcissist is like a bucket with a hole in the bottom. No matter how much you put in, you can never fill it up. The phrase, "I feel like I'm never enough," is the mantra of the person in the narcissistic relationship. That's because to your narcissistic partner, you're not. No one is. Nothing is. Ramani Dervsavula. All right, now that we know what a narcissist is, let's talk about what a narcissist does or how they operate in the world. First and foremost, you need to know that it is easy to fall for a narcissist, and I mean in any capacity, like a loving relationship or admiration or anything. They have a lot of success-driven traits. They're charming, talented, they have a lot of charisma. Typically, they have all the things that, especially in our culture in America, deem as successful. There's a lot of research that shows that narcissism actually helps people get what they want. Like, they get more money, more power, they have more sex, they're more uninhibited, and they take more risks. So, you know, the bigger the risk, the bigger reward. And they are also much more likely to do what they want, even though it has a negative effect on somebody else. So being around a narcissist can be exhilarating. It could be really fun. They're also master manipulators, but just who they are as people is just really attractive. People gravitate towards them. But ultimately, it's also destructive to be around them. They lead to shaky relationships, poor decisions, and, you know, a lot of addiction, money, drugs, power, fame, all that. So, you know, it's important to know that it's really easy to be attracted to a narcissist. And we as a society have kind of elevated or put on a pedestal exactly the character traits that narcissists have. You know, I don't know if it's a what came first, chicken or the egg, but I can say that especially in America, money, power, sex, talent, fame, name dropping, you know, those are the things that a lot of people look for, not only in a mate, but in friend relationships, business relationships. And so, you know, it suggests that a lot of us are actually attracted to narcissists. And I think that's a scary thought, you know, but it's important to think about, again, because they can be really destructive in our lives. Because at home, narcissists are completely different than they are their public personas. And mostly that's because at home, they feel more free to demand what they want, which is this appreciation of how special they are, this admiration, and they want really specific responses for the demands that they have. And if you don't have them, basically, if you don't say how high when they say jump, they can lash out and get really upset and also criticize a lot. Stick situations comes from is because if someone in a relationship with a narcissist stands up for themselves, they will have consequences. The narcissist has to protect themselves from the shame and humiliation they feel when the person in the relationship stands up to them. So the person in the relationship is not necessarily slighting them in any way or, you know, being rude. They could just be, you know, standing up for themselves, assertive claiming. And the narcissist will still be offended by that because of their high, high sensitivity to humiliation and shame. They don't like to hear no, and they will manipulate people to get their way. And that manipulation has a lot of forms. It could be guilt. It could be bullying, taunting. There's just a lot of different ways that they do that, but they will manipulate to get their way because their relationships are really a means to an end. They, again, see people as an extension of themselves. So you are just a way for them to get what they want in life. And it's interesting because you would think that by viewing you as an extension of themselves, they would respect you that much more. But you have to remember that narcissists are plagued with self-hatred, self-loathing, inferiority complex, they don't love themselves. And so thinking that you are an extension of themselves will not make them respect you more. In fact, it's one of the many reasons why it's so easy for them to discard your feelings, because they really don't have feelings for themselves. So just remember that anything that they do is really a projection of something that they would do to themselves, because when it comes down to it, the facade of the confidence and the braggadociousness is really a facade. It's there because deep down, they don't have that confidence. When you think about someone with confidence that you know, true confidence, they don't feel the need to bring people down, to be a bully, to taunt. People who have those behaviors deep down clearly have a self-worth issue. Going back to how narcissists operate, not only do they manipulate, but they also have insatiable need. The relationship with the narcissist, regardless of what the relationship is, it could be a parent-child relationship, but they will still have endless needs that they expect everyone in relation with them to meet. Those needs can be admiration, they could be service. That service could be sexual service, that could be just, you know, cleaning, housekeeping, whatever service. It could be love that they're expecting, it could be gifts, you know, whatever needs that they have, they expect everyone in relationship to meet them whenever they have them. And then if they don't meet them, they either dismiss them or they attack them. So obviously, if you're in a relationship with someone who's essentially a bottomless pit of need, you're going to feel tense. You're going to feel drained. If you're getting unpredictable tantrums because you didn't anticipate somebody's need, or you didn't meet a need that can't be filled, you're going to feel attacked. There's possibly false accusations involved, criticism. There's unjustified indignation for things that are kind of just like made up imaginary slights. You can not mean to do something, but a narcissist will take it as a slight. So, you know, that's like walking on eggshells all the time, always trying to anticipate the need of the narcissist that you're in relationship with, always being consumed with how they feel, even more than how you feel. And that's kind of self-preservation. If you're in that kind of relationship, you're thinking, okay, if I can anticipate what they want for dinner, I don't care what I want to eat. I just don't want to get yelled at, or I don't want to, in extreme cases, get hit. So I'm just going to figure out what that person needs before what I need. So you lose confidence in yourself because you're not able to assert yourself without feeling blamed or attacked. You're not able to have your own wants and desires because you're always thinking about this other person. So again, that's why I consider it an entanglement, because your life becomes their life and you're always thinking about them before yourself, and not in a healthy way that, you know, when you fall in love and you're just thinking about somebody first and you're nurturing them. I'm talking about in a terrified, fearful way that if you don't think about this person's needs first, you can have damage inflicted on you. That is not healthy. And that is very illustrative of a relationship with someone who's a narcissist. And I think one of the ways that they employ looking at all the ways that the narcissist operates, I think the two main weapons they employ are invalidation and projection. And invalidation may seem kind of not that important, but it really attacks a core human need, which is validation. We all want to be accepted or validated. You know, validation is essentially providing a presence or support of someone's experience by acknowledging their thoughts and feelings and also not attempting to change them. Validation is not agreeing with someone. It is simply providing presence and a listening ear and acceptance of their feelings and thoughts. without necessarily agreeing with them. And invalidation, on the other hand, is purposefully denying, rejecting, minimizing, negatively judging, or even ignoring someone's expressed experience or thoughts or actions or emotions. So, you know, if this core human need that is universal, that we all have to be validated, is attacked by this interaction with a narcissist, you know, it can really get to the root of who somebody is as a person, which is where the damage comes from. And because narcissists have an innate lack of empathy, they don't really feel the damage that they're inflicting on others. And that's not to say they don't know it. You know, I'm not making an excuse that they have no idea what they're doing, but I will say that they can't viscerally feel what they're inflicting on other people because they have a lack of empathy. And, you know, sometimes the invalidation can be overt and sometimes it can be covert, but ultimately it's a manipulation tactic to get what the narcissist wants. So if I want something from you as a narcissist and you tell me no, I'm going to invalidate your opinions, your thoughts about the issue, because I want you to tell me yes to whatever it is that I want. And I think one of the most employed ways that narcissists do this is gaslighting. And I think it's one of those terms, almost like a buzzword we hear a lot now, and partly because it's happening to us a lot now. But I think that gaslighting also has misconceptions along with narcissism, but it's really something that we need to know. And I wish would become like household knowledge, because it plays out in so many situations in our daily lives. And if we don't know and have the critical capacity to figure it out, we can see a lot of harm. So gaslighting, it has its roots in a man who would turn his like gas lights, like lanterns in the hallway in his house, on and off to make his wife seem unstable. And so she was eventually sent to an asylum so he could get on with his life and marry somebody else. So that's gaslighting. Essentially, making someone feel unstable or unsure about their lived experience so that you can make them feel powerless in a conversation or a situation. And like I said, I feel like we're experiencing that a lot right now as a nation. And more specifically as Black people. And I wouldn't say that that's new to the Black experience. I think maybe it's just becoming more called out. But, you know, every day, I think even in just America as a whole, we're hearing information that is telling us your lived experience is not true and it's not valid, because it doesn't match my agenda. So I'm going to manipulate you into thinking that what you're thinking and you're feeling and you're observing is not real and it's not true, so that you can continue with my status quo and my plan of action. And like I said, it's really damaging. If you look back at the original example or where the word came from, the woman was sent to an asylum. I mean, to a point where her life was ruined because of the situation. And that happens every day with gaslighting. You see people who gradually go into such deep self-doubt because they're constantly gaslit and they feel that they don't know themselves and they don't know the truth. And, you know, that's really painful experience, especially when you're insisting and you know what the truth is, but you're being gaslit into being told that your opinions or your truth is invalid. It's just like it sounds. The narcissist projects their own negative feelings onto the person that they're in a relationship with. And again, when I'm saying in a relationship with, I mean any relationship. It could be work, it could be family, and we'll go into kind of more specifically how narcissists act in these different settings, but I mean any relationship. A narcissist will try to deflect from the fact that they feel inferior and distract themselves by making you feel inferior. So it's, you know, saying, I'm not inferior, you are. Maybe I'll feel better about myself if I talk about all the negative qualities that you have, or rather project my malignant qualities onto you. So a couple ways that you can experience this from a narcissist is, number one, nitpicking and exaggerating. You know, nothing that you do will ever feel good enough, because a narcissist will nitpick small flaws, they'll exaggerate tiny things, and they'll just make it seem like you really should not have tried because of all the flaws that they point out. But again, that's because they feel very flawed within themselves. Sometimes the projection will result in crocodile tears or emotional manipulation. They will switch the blame, so to speak, to try to make you feel badly about how they are treating you. And that projection is, again, kind of like almost a guilt that they're feeling that they want to project onto you. They know that they may have engaged in negative behavior, but again, with the false accusations, sometimes they will accuse you falsely because they want to project that guilt onto somebody. In a lot of situations, the projection might also turn to sabotage. They feel that something that they are working on, or kind of a commitment that they've made to a project, may not be going the way in which they want it to. And then they see that you're succeeded in something. A narcissist may try to sabotage you to distract from their own inferior feelings about whatever project or work that they're engaged in. So projection can be really damaging also, in addition to just, I think, being corrosive for the victim. It gets to your soul in terms of your self-worth and who you are. And, you know, again, shame. When we talk about shame, it's the intrinsic feeling that you're unlovable and that you're not worthy of connection. And so if someone's nitpicking you, exaggerating all your flaws, emotionally manipulating, falsely accusing you, sabotaging you, you will feel that you're not worthy of love and affection. And that's really the narcissist's goal. Their goal is to make other people feel that way so that they can continue to control them. So we have to know their intentions and see through their behavior to protect ourselves. In family relationships, I think projection and invalidation are kind of glossed over because we don't want to think about our family members as inflicting narcissistic abuse against us. But again, this is not just romantic relationships. Narcissistic abusive relationships play out in many different scenarios. I think one of the most poignant things about narcissism that connects it to family relationships is this idea that the person that they're in a relationship is an extension of themselves. And I think I see that a lot in the parent-child narcissist victim relationship, where, and I think parents naturally maybe always see themselves as, or their children as, extension of themselves, just because, you know, they are. But this idea that your child is not their own person and they're not independent of you, they are purely an extension of yourself. And that can be really damaging to a child. They're always trying to figure out who they are because their parent won't allow them to become anyone other than an extension of themselves. And I think you see that a lot with parents shaming their children into, you know, don't embarrass me. You know, your accomplishments are my accomplishments. I'm bragging about you, or maybe even shaming you in public, because your accomplishments are essentially an extension of mine and I don't want to be embarrassed. And again, I think we all know, or we are that person who has been damaged by that. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of money in therapy to heal from things like that. So it's important to accept that just because it came from family and people who share your DNA doesn't mean that it wasn't narcissistic abuse. Especially because codependency and narcissism go hand in hand, and codependency is so latent in family structures. We just have this tendency to be codependent with each other. And in a really unhealthy way. I know for myself, I'm very much a codependent giver, and I'll put in the show notes the book that changed my life in learning about who I am in that way and what that means. But, you know, when you're a codependent giver, it's a perfect storm with a narcissist, because your entire purpose in life is to be loved through giving and doing. And the narcissist's entire purpose in life is to take. So it's a, you know, match made in hell, so to speak. But it's so common. I think so many people are in those type of relationships, but they just don't recognize it because, again, it's really hard to admit that the person that you're in a relationship with, or your mom or your dad, is a narcissist. I think another way that I see narcissistic parents abusing their children is through abuse amnesia. This idea that they never inflicted the trauma that they inflicted on their children. And I guess, again, I'm not a parent, and maybe it's true that, you know, the things that you say to someone that really mark them don't mark you as much as they do. But again, going back to validation and invalidation, a narcissist parent will not validate the trauma that they inflicted on you, even if they don't remember it. And even if they do remember it, they won't validate your experience. And I think that's a big difference between someone who doesn't remember it, because, you know, that can happen. I don't think I remember every time that I was mean to my sister, and I'm sure there's times that she'll remember that I don't. But if she comes to me and expresses the trauma and I say, I don't remember that, that never happened, you're crazy, then I am narcissistically abusing her in that moment. And I think we see that a lot, again, with parent-child situations and even with sibling relationships. I definitely have that issue with my brother. I think that I'm not a doctor, so I won't diagnose him in any way, but I think that my initial interactions with narcissism came from my brother and just behaviors that he had. One of which is one of the things that I saw listed that narcissists employ, which are insults as jokes, which, you know, again, I think that's just something that siblings do to each other, always, you know, making fun of each other. But I've learned a lot from Brené Brown, obviously. And one thing she's talked about on her podcast a few times, and I think even in a couple books, is how she does not allow her children to make fun of each other, that she will stop the conversation immediately and say, you cannot speak to them like that. I would not allow someone to speak to you like that. And I love that, because we definitely did not have that in my house. And it gave me a lot to think about, because when you start extrapolating the jokes that you were possibly told by your siblings, or you told about your siblings or your cousins, to adult life and bullying in the workplace or in relationships, I mean, it's not a hard connection to make. Like, having this practice of insulting people or teasing people as a joke, which, you know, eventually turns to bullying, is really not a good practice. It's not funny. It's not something to get used to doing. And it doesn't go away easily. I think in my household, that was maybe called banter some ways. And, you know, I think I've spoken about this before, and we just kind of have that as a family. But I'm really looking now at how those things could have really been shame triggering and narcissistic abusive characteristics that were very common in my household that I just thought were normal. And they did affect me, because I do believe that once you kind of get, I'm going to use the word groomed, that might not be the best word, but once you have an experience with a narcissist or someone who exhibits narcissistic tendencies, I feel like you are kind of groomed to attract or choose other narcissists that you may meet in your life. So it's important to just kind of know initially how narcissism could have played out in your formative years to cause some of the behavior that you've shown in your later years. And speaking of work relationships, I think I think these are the most difficult in that you can't necessarily do anything about them. It's one thing to have a family relationship with a narcissist. You can go no contact and block them. A romantic relationship, it's difficult also, but same thing. I think a work relationship, I mean, you can't quit your job every time you have a narcissist colleague or boss, because frankly, you'd be quitting all the time, or you'd have to work for yourself, because a lot of financially successful people are narcissistic. Politicians also, it's studied. Many CEOs and executives are narcissists, and you can't go no contact with your boss or your supervisor or, you know, even a colleague. So it's really important for the self-management piece that you remember why they are the way they are. It's insecurity. If someone is nitpicking a project that you worked really hard on, exaggerating your flaws, stealing your spotlight, controlling conversations, being hypersensitive to your very constructive criticism, being charming but not having any follow-through or accountability, name-dropping constantly, feeling entitled to break the rules, using hierarchy all the time, you know, always feeling like they're superior or someone else is inferior, or just honestly being emotionally toxic. None of those things are about you. They're about the narcissist's insecurity, and it plays out in work, especially because, again, they're really kind of driven by egotism, and it lends them or encourages them to seek out positions of leadership. So, of course, in the workplace, if you're trying to climb up the corporate ladder, you are going to show your hand, so to speak. And people gravitate towards these characteristics, even though it doesn't sound like it when you list them out. Like when you list all the things that I just said, it's like, oh my gosh, I hate that person. But honestly, don't we want to network with the person who drops names because we know they know people, or the charming person, or the person who, you know, talks a lot in a conversation because honestly, you don't want to speak. You know, there's things that attract us to narcissists. That's why they are successful. But there's a lot of negative behaviors that are associated with them. And sometimes it takes a while to find out these things. I think that's especially true in romantic relationships, but also at work. You can have tertiary dealings with somebody and think, you know, that's a great person because of the narcissistic characteristics they have, and then those, that same narcissistic characteristic that you once thought was a good thing, with a little more knowledge you realize it's really negative. So again, in work relationships, I think just recognizing the traits and why people are the way they are will help you a lot in management, because you can't necessarily rid yourself from these relationships. Now in romantic relationships, however, you can make a difference. It's hard. I can tell you from experience, it is very hard, but it's so necessary and it's very life-changing. I think the hard part about romantic relationships with narcissists is that they are drawn to their opposites, and that's because they want to fill the emptiness they have inside. And that's an interesting concept, because we talk about narcissists usually being really successful, but a funny quote that I saw is that a narcissist is either, well, it's honestly not funny, I shouldn't say that. A narcissist is either in the boardroom or a homeless shelter because of just how driven they are, but also how their vices can get to them. And when you think about opposites, you know, it's not necessary that, oh, well, narcissists are so successful, so I must be a bum if a narcissist wanted me. It's actually quite the opposite. There's a lot of narcissists that are not successful and they seek out really successful people. Or there's a lot of narcissists who are not as extroverted as the common ideal of what a narcissist is, and they look for an extrovert. You know, they just look for someone that they feel will fill their own emptiness. And, you know, I experienced that myself. The narcissistic relationship that caused me to even learn about narcissism was that exact situation. I was out of college. Yeah, I had graduated. I was working. You know, I had a career. I had an apartment, a car, And I fell for a narcissist who had none of those things, like nothing. And, you know, a lot of my healing was spent criticizing myself for that. How did you get in a situation with someone like him? And how did that situation bring you to the point it did? Because ultimately, I was at rock bottom. I was sleeping on people's couches. I didn't have a job. I had to start from scratch. I lost 2 cars in the span of 6 months. Yeah, I mean, it was really bad. I had to start from square one, literally, to rebuild my life. And part of that rebuilding process was learning about narcissism so I could heal myself emotionally before I got tangible items. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you get a new job, if you buy a new car, if you haven't handled what's going on with you emotionally, you'll be right back in the situation in a year or two. So ultimately, like I said, a lot of my growth was having grace for myself and learning that narcissists are attracted to their opposites because they want to fulfill what's lacking inside of them. Another thing that I had to have grace with myself for was just how long it took me to get out of that relationship, because on paper, it looks terrible. If I write down 5 things about that relationship, anybody would say, what were you doing? But I think there's a cycle of abuse that narcissists are really good at perfecting that includes love bombs. And a love bomb is something that perpetuates the cycle of abuse by making you forget the abuse. It facilitates the cycle by, you know, bringing in this blissful period after this really abusive incident. And so you forget and you think about how great they are. And, you know, you might get a dozen roses or a house full of roses or a new watch or a new car. I mean, there's a lot of things. The sky is the limit with a narcissist. And they know what you want because they're very good at manipulating. So maybe it's not tangible things. Whatever it is that they know you want, they will bomb you with it. Literally bomb. It's an explosion of it. And then they will have abuse amnesia and they'll inflict it with you too. And, you know, that's something that really makes it difficult to walk away. Because the moment in which you feel ready to walk away, you'll be bombed with some expression of love that makes you think, well, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe he learned this time. Or again, even in other situations, I've seen this with work where I've been yelled at by a boss and then all of a sudden we have like kolaches at work, or, hey, let's all take the half day, or, you know, just even in parental relationships, you get blown up at, and then all of a sudden it's like, you want to go get ice cream? I mean, this is in all relationships, the love bomb. And it works. I mean, it really works. And they know it works, which is why they employ it. So we have to know going into situations what the narcissist is going to employ so that we don't fall for it. And that doesn't mean we won't. It just means we'll be better equipped. And I think another really dangerous part of romantic relationships with narcissists is how your life becomes consumed with filling their needs or fulfilling their needs. And like I said, that's all needs, including sex. Narcissists are notorious for using sex as a weapon against their abuse victims. And, you know, that's something that goes back to the destruction of self-worth and value, and thinking that you are not worth love. Again, shame. So they will employ these things to shame their partner into thinking that they don't deserve better so that they won't leave until they are done with the romantic partner, and then they'll discard them. So that's the other thing. After all of this, when the narcissist is ready to move on, they'll move on. In a lot of cases, a narcissist has what they call the backup need filler, or someone who's there ready to fulfill all the needs that you may or may not fulfill. And so when they're ready to dispose of you, I mean, it's just that disposal, like trash. And everything that you've invested goes out the window for you. And it's hard. You don't lose the feelings for the person, even if they are a narcissist, even if you do come to the realization overnight. It takes time. And that's another reason why you really have to have grace with yourself. And again, another reason why I think prevention is better than the cure. If you can see these signs early on, it will still be tough to end the relationship or the situationship or whatever it is. But if you see them early and you can find the strength to make a hard decision and go no contact, set your boundaries, I'm telling you, it'll be so much easier in the end, because the more deeply you get involved, the more difficult it is to leave. But that's the thing about narcissists. They can try to fool you with all their heart, but in the end, they're just fooling themselves. Ellie Fox. So the big question is, how do we heal from narcissistic abuse? I have to tell you that when I was researching the steps to heal from narcissistic abuse, I realized that I had followed these steps unknowingly in my own healing journey, which started about 8 years ago in 2013. So when I'm giving you these, they're things that I've learned not only from experience, but also from articles and books. So I can tell you that, at least in my experience, they work. And like I said, you have to give yourself some time. In some cases, it might be lifelong work, but it's worth it, because the self-worth that you gain back from this healing process is immeasurable. You will never be able to put a price on what it means to get yourself back, honestly. So I think the first thing that is really helpful to do and was a game changer for me is to acknowledge and accept that it is abuse that you survived. Denial is the narcissist's greatest weapon. Again, very similar to racism, denial is what perpetuates it and confession is what ends it. Same thing. In narcissism, the narcissist is trying to make you deny that they're abusing you, and it works and it sticks with you. And I think for me, especially coming from my culture, the idea of abuse, it has to be really extreme, because even things that honestly are abuse, Kenyan people would say, you know, that's just a normal beating, or, you know, that's just discipline. But so, you know, thinking that something is abusive, I have to, in my head, it has to be really extreme, I think. And so it was hard for me to think that I was an abuse survivor. There's no way. I don't have black eyes or broken bones, but it doesn't matter. What I experienced through this narcissist, and I think multiple experiences with narcissistic behavior, they were abuse, and I have to treat it as such. The second key to healing from narcissism is setting boundaries and stating them clearly. I think it's generally accepted that the best solution possible is to cut all communication or go no contact with your narcissist. But like we talked about, that's not always possible. So, you know, your alternative is to cut the emotional attachment and set emotional boundaries. And that's difficult, especially if you're codependent like myself. Setting boundaries can feel impossible, but there's a lot of good work out there on developing boundaries and how to state them clearly, which is especially important. And, you know, having consequences for not respecting your boundaries is going to be really important. And if you can't necessarily carry out those consequences, again, like in a work situation, it's important to keep the emotional boundaries. So saying, I will not have that conversation with you, and letting it be clear. And, you know, you can't be forced to have conversations. So just helping yourself to emotionally disconnect from the abuse, whether you can do that physically or otherwise, is really important. Also, embracing and understanding your emotions, because they are very complex. How can you love someone who abuses you? How can you love someone who doesn't know what love is? How can your parent be an abuser? I mean, there's just so many things that are going on emotionally. And this is going to require you to emotionally grapple with things that you may not have in the past. And it's also going to require you to improve your emotional intelligence. There's a really amazing book by, I believe, Mark Brackett about emotional intelligence. Of course, I'll put the name in the notes. It has been really helpful to me to determine what my emotions are and why I'm responding in certain ways. This is real trauma that you experience from narcissistic abuse, real trauma. So it's important to understand all the complex emotions that go with that and to give yourself some grace for them. Another thing that's really important, and it was for me especially, and it may seem superficial, but it really is to reclaim your identity. And I have to tell you, when I was in my narcissistic abusive romantic relationship, well, the main one that caused me a lot of harm, I let myself go completely. And I mean, like, I looked different. People would tell me that. They would say that I just looked tired or just, you know, I looked different. And after I ended the relationship, I started reclaiming myself, going back to the things I used to do, you know, looks wise, makeup and hair, and even buying clothes. And going back to my friendships, you know, narcissists will try to seclude you from people that you will go to in trouble. And so your friendships may be compromised. So reclaiming that back, you know, just really reclaiming all the things that make you you. Maybe hobbies that a narcissist has shamed you for. Oh, you're not great at painting. You're not good at singing. You know, all those things that make you who you are, get those back. It is so critical to take time to find you again. That may require some self-compassion and grace. Maybe you're not ready to get back into it. Maybe it's going to take some time. That's okay. It's going to take time to heal, especially from narcissistic abuse. They get in your bones. They get in your head. And so you have to be okay with, number one, the fact that you were with them in the first place. And number two, the fact that you've made a really hard and brave decision to heal from this, and it's going to take some time. And you're going to have to care for yourself. Self-care is so critical. And I'm not talking about just in the, like, you know, jade roller kind of way, but I mean true self-care, things that make you happy, that feed your soul. Engage in them. They are so critical because, again, that's what a narcissist does. It just corrodes your soul, your self-worth, things that make you feel beautiful, things that make you feel alive, they want to take from you. So you really have to get that back through self-care practices and, yeah, just having self-care in a way that, for once in such a long time while you've been dealing with this narcissist, you're putting yourself first. And that's not a bad thing. It's especially coming from narcissistic abuse. It's so important that you do that. I think the last thing that is really important to healing from narcissistic abuse, and I think it's the most difficult to do, is to speak your experience. It can be really shameful and really embarrassing to talk about your narcissistic experience. I know it was for me. Mostly because of what I said, that I just couldn't believe that someone, quote unquote, like myself could get with someone like, quote unquote, that. And that's, again, shame. Shame must be spoken in order to be healed. Just like that, the shame that you experience from your narcissistic abuse must be spoken in order to be healed. It is really imperative that you are careful with who you share your experiences with and who you choose to be vulnerable with. You know, I highly recommend going to a support group like Narcissistic Abuse Support or CODA, which is Codependence Anonymous. I think those can really be beneficial because people know what you're going through and especially don't have the potential connection to your narcissistic abuser. In a lot of cases, when you're talking about someone in this manner, people who love them can be offended. You know, it's hard to hear that your daughter, son, in-law, colleague, whoever, is a narcissist and is abusing someone. Again, that word abuse has a lot of connotation. And so if someone hears that you are expressing your experience of abuse with someone that they love or care about, they may use that against you, or it may just end up being a really unconstructive conversation. So again, although I highly encourage you to speak your experience, be really careful and make sure it's someone you can trust. I highly recommend therapy. this is really soul wrenching work, healing from narcissism. So, you know, getting a professional involved is always a recommended thing to do. Even if you've never been to a therapist before, this is a great first experience because you have something that you're going with. I think a lot of people are afraid of stepping into therapy for the first time, or maybe not even afraid. They think that they don't have anything to talk about. I don't have any issues. I'm not quote unquote crazy. But if you feel that you have experienced narcissistic abuse, I would highly recommend picking up the phone and scheduling time to speak to a therapist, because they're a safe place for you to express what you've experienced. And experience once again, and maybe for the first time, what it's like to be validated. That in and of itself will change your life. Lastly, as I said before, I think the best solution to healing from narcissism is to honestly not get hurt by a narcissist in the first place. That's really difficult. You can't always make that choice. But again, I just really wanted to give you a picture of how they operate and what they kind of look like in our lives, so that you can, you know, set up boundaries quickly and not get too enmeshed with a narcissist in your life. Once again, I really hope that this was meaningful for you, that you learned something, that it was helpful. I'm not a psychologist, but I really felt a deep call to share what I've learned about narcissism with you. So leave me your feedback. If it has been helpful, let me know. If it wasn't, let me know, but maybe do that in the DMs, like not in public on the comments. I'm just playing, you know, feel free to leave them wherever you want. But thank you so much for your interactions on social media, for subscribing, for following. Please continue to do so. If you like what you're hearing, share about it with your friends. Leave reviews. I heard those are important. So if you have time, please leave one. Again, I'm just so grateful for all of you. Thank you so much. Till next week, I'm really excited. My friend Marshall, who, if you've listened to my first couple episodes, I've talked about him. He's going to be my first guest host. He is an incredible powerhouse voice. Just the way he speaks and how he thinks about the world will change you, honestly. I'm not being dramatic. I'm very protective of you as my audience. I would never have someone that I didn't think was going to bring value to your life. So I'm really excited for you to hear our two conversations, one starting next week and one the week after. This life is crazy. Take care of yourself. Until next time, be safe.